So if we look at the Aboriginal songlines, where they sing country site by site so they can move right across country, it's been talked about as a navigation device. But it's not just that. At each one of those locations, they perform a ritual. Now, ritual means a repeated act, and the songs that they repeat at these locations encode all the practical information on which their survival depends. It's the same method as the ancient Greeks and Romans used, their orators used, except they used a built environment, a building or a streetscape. So by embedding information in a fixed order in country, they have got a permanent reminder of it.
So you're saying it's not just that Indigenous people that you looked at were encoding into song and dance the things that they needed to remember. They were then linking that to place.
Absolutely. And all modern memory champions use the same method. Nothing's been found better, because the human brain is the human brain, and that's the way it works ultimately. So the Native American pilgrimage trails, the Inca Kex, or their imagined pathways, they all work exactly the same way. But then the Indigenous methods are much more complex than the Greek and Roman. And we know Homer could reel off stuff for, you know, five nights in a row going for hours without any prompt. He was using this sort of method.
So this is the method we know most about. This is why when I listen to a podcast, I can remember where I was on my run when that particular bit of information came up about whatever in the podcast. And this is called loci. This is something that Western civilizations understand. And the idea was that you'd take a map of a house and you'd remember each bit of the podcast or each bit of the table you were trying to remember in chemistry or whatever, depending on the part of the house. So how does that basic Western system work?
Exactly the way you describe it. So I've got over 1,000 locations in action now. But if you walk around my garden and house, I've got every country in the world in order, in population order. So I start with China in the studio where I work, walk around the garden. By the time I leave the house, I'm up to number 120. So I'm up to Central African Republic, then I go all the way down the street and end up at Pitcairn Islands with a population of 66 or whatever.
So when you see the hydrangea 100 metres from where your computer is, you think, aha!
That's Q8. Exactly. And so if any of these things are mentioned, my brain, without even trying, will go to that location. So it gives you a hook for everything. And this is what I think we've lost in education. We teach literacy. We don't learn orality. Indigenous cultures, it's commonly said they didn't leave a written record. What they did wasn't to do with what they didn't have, it's what they did have. They did have an alternative, orality, these memory methods. So they'd use handheld devices as well, like their Aboriginal Chiringa, the African Lakasa. These are handheld devices with abstract signs or stones or shells or whatever. And doing the same thing, locating a piece of information with each location on that handheld device.
We're in the middle of the Tanami Desert now. There's not a hydrangea in sight.
Exactly.
there's not anything in sight except more of the Tanami Desert. What does what I have been taught as an Indigenous person say in terms of dance and song tell me about where I am?
There's nothing in sight for you. It's amazing what an Indigenous person will see. So if you look at the Inuit navigating the ice, which is moving and changing and no land marks, they will still do it. They'll use the stars partly, but that can only work on a fine night. We're not going to limit their navigation to a fine night. They will use angles of snowdrifts. So in a desert, you can use angles of sand drift, which relate to the wind angles and therefore the seasonality. They'll use weather indicators, all sorts of combination, animal behaviour, bird behaviour, and plants that we, and insects and animals that we would not even notice. So there's a lot of signs there, just not what you would notice.
And so they have taught that from generation to generation. Coming back to Australian Indigenous people, how do those long songs help with navigation?
They will sing the landscape. And that is effectively, one elder explained to me, we're singing a set of subheadings to all the information. So the long songs and the origin stories of the original ancestors tell of how the landscape was made, and that gives you the landscape shape and geography, but also of every animal and plant and everything else that was made within it. Now, there's studies that show Aboriginal cultures can memorise things over 7,000, if not more, years. That's how robust these memory methods are. Mythology, song and dance are far more memorable than a list of facts. So in schools, we should have people singing and dancing around the classroom. It is more effective. You know, you can get a song caught in your head. You never get a list of facts caught in your head.
That's right, the earworm. And what about things like you looked at, it was not just a sense of place and what was around you in Aboriginal long songs in terms of navigation. It was almost, as you say, a field guide of animals. So how do they embed into a song information about how a kangaroo might react in given circumstances, and how useful is that?
Let's look at what's termed hunting magic, because we don't have a better word for this in English. So a group of Aboriginal men on their way out for a hunt will dance the behaviour of the kangaroo and sing their hunting strategies. So they will dance the movement of the ears, which tells them whether it's detected them, the tracks that they might follow and so on, which means that before they go out on that hunt, they are all attuned to all the information they'd need, how to communicate with each other, because if you're going to yell out to each other, hey, he's over there, mate, you're not going to get that kangaroo.
You'll be very unpopular on the long walk home.
Exactly. So the singing, reenacting of the ancestors or the animal behaviour or whatever, it's all integrated together. They don't separate each part of the information system.
Lynn Kelly is with us on Life Matters. She's rediscovered ways humanity used memory to store huge amounts of knowledge and know-how. The book is called The Memory Code. So that's Indigenous Australians, some Indigenous Australians, because Australia was a multilingual, multicultural society. So saying you know one thing about one group of Indigenous people doesn't tell you much about another group of Australian Indigenous people.
The methods were common. The beliefs and actual songs and so on were not, but these memory methods, not only Australian Aboriginal, I've shown that these are part of non-literate cultures across the world because it's the most effective way for the human brain to work.
Let's turn to the amazing navigators of the Pacific, the notion that a Polynesian person could get in a small boat into the vast Pacific Ocean and wind up where he or she wanted to wind up. How did they gather all that information about how to navigate and then pass it on without ever writing anything down?
They were in schools. There's a myth around that Indigenous people somehow just know stuff from being out on the gather and hunt or chatting around the campfire. It's never like that. They formally teach. So there were navigation schools. They were elite and restricted. And information is restricted, secret business in Aboriginal terms, because that stops it getting corrupted, that stops the so-called Chinese whispers effect. So the navigators would train probably 10 years at least
schools.
Absolutely. On land using stick charts as a memory device and training in the water to the extent that they would step out of those boats and use their scrotum or hang it over the side if it was a bit deep to get the angle of the waves. That's how sensitive the angles were. They could detect the change in a way a waveform acts, 100 kilometres from land.
So it was no surprise when land came over the horizon. They knew it would be where they thought it would be.
Absolutely, plus the animal behaviour. If you look at the behaviour, so there's one bird called the loon or the red-throated diver right across the northern areas that is not pelagic. That is, it's a bird that returns to land every night. A lot of seabirds don't. So by singing the song of the call of the loon, if you get caught in bad weather, can't see anything, as long as you follow that call, you will get back to land. Now, the Pacific navigators knew the behaviour of all the fish. We're talking a massive taxonomy of fish and birds and other sea creatures in order to detect. Some are only near land, some behave particular ways in different seasons and so on. So you're putting together a mass of environmental information to give, and luminescence, the different way light reflects, to give this sort of total picture of what's out there in the ocean.
Little wonder then that the navigators find Easter Island, Then there are these mysterious statues on Easter Island. What are they? And are they part of a way of remembering key knowledge?
Yes. Easter Island was a bit of a challenge compared to Stonehenge and the other sites, which reflect the way landscape has to be localised in order to settle. But the Pacific cultures, and we learn a lot from the Maori, they index their knowledge system or structure it on genealogies, on past forebears or mythological ancestors. Which they are is another whole complex as well.
And why is that useful? Why is it useful to talk about a particular god or a particular ancestor in order to remember key survival information?
Right. The term god doesn't tend to come up in these cultures. They talk about mythological ancestors and spiritual ancestors because they don't worship particular gods and the information is adjusted. It's useful because they then have a structure. You need a structure to hang each piece of information off or it will be forgotten. So the Maori, for example, use sticks, genealogy sticks, where each knob on the stick represents one more ancestor from the original founder.
And what information do you make yourself remember around that little knot on the stick?
Everything from the history of the time, what was taught at that time, but also animal knowledge, navigation, all these sort of things are all hooked into that structure. They then use the landscape as well and a whole combination. But Pacific Islanders use genealogies and landscape with the genealogies dominating. Aboriginal and most other cultures I looked at use the landscape as the dominant system and genealogies as well, are extremely complex. So with Easter Island, what they've done when they've landed there is built the statues of the ancestors, whether they be mythological or actual forebears. They've had to replicate those on land in order to not lose all the information that they have are bringing with them.
This is the Sandstone University. That's what you're looking at if you know what you're looking at.
Absolutely.
Yeah. One of the things that most astounds me is advanced astronomy when you don't have a written culture, because it requires observations over time. If you want to know, about eclipses and all the rest of it, you need years of observations and you need to keep going over those in your mind in order to draw patterns, in order to understand what you're looking at in the skies, which seems an extraordinary thing to do without ever writing anything down. But I suppose things were written down. Take me to the Nazca people in the deserts of Peru.
Right. This is science. I was told at the beginning that science is a Western construct and not practiced by Indigenous people. No, the Indigenous people I talked to agree. Nazca was one area where it's claimed that this is Peru on the desert, where they have the huge animal glyphs, animal impressions, which von Daniken and others have said can only be viewed from the sky and above, therefore was aliens and things. It's not. They can be viewed from the hillsides, but that's because we work on viewing all the time. There's also a huge number of straight lines and abstract stuff as well. These were designed to be walked, and the archaeologists have now shown they were made by clearing the dark stones away to make walked pathways that left a clear, unvarnished underneath, which shows up clear. But all of those glyphs, no matter how complex, can be walked from a single file, then no line ever crosses another one. And Indigenous cultures have told me so much that walking and chanting in rhythms is highly valuable as a memory aid.
So also when you say glyphs, this might be the pattern of a giant pelican that is represented in the landscape in a single unbroken line, this vast thing, which is interesting that we reach for, well, these Indigenous people couldn't have done it, must have been aliens, must have been a quote-unquote higher culture. That's fascinating. But so if you sing and walk this glyph, what do you understand?
You're singing the knowledge. In non-literate cultures, knowledge is performed. Dance, song, vivid stories make information memorable.
And what information is this?
We're the same, going back to the same information. There will be beliefs and history, but there will be the behaviour of the animals. So, for example, the pelican is well represented over there. It's a huge, and the condor and other animals that are part of their environment. So it will be their behaviour, because that gives seasonal abilities, because you were talking about the astronomy. Astronomy is used to manage time. But animal behaviour is also used in coordination with that. So, for example, they'd use the behaviour of particular migratory birds to indicate when the weather is changing and when to plant crops. So it's all integrated together in practical information.
Ellen Fanning with you on Life Matters, and I'm talking to Lynn Kelly about her book, her theory, The Memory Code. There was a moment that you describe in the book where you're at Stonehenge and presumably you've got a headset on amongst the tourists.
Exactly.
And there's this lightning bolt. What was the thought that you had that struck you so powerfully there?
I had no interest in archaeology. My husband just graduated in archaeology and we'd gone to Stonehenge. My head was full of these knowledge systems and the use of the landscape, and in particular Australian Aboriginal songlines. And it occurred to me, what's going to happen if they're going to settle? They can't afford to lose all this information, but they are no longer mobile on the annual cycle right around the landscape.
So in other words, you're not walking around that annually and therefore passing that knowledge on to the younger people the whole time. You're going to have to somehow have a record of it to tell them about it.
Exactly. And the obvious way to replicate a landscape journey over an annual cycle is a series of locations, is a set of stones or timbers in a circle. I was going mad. I was keeping two PhD topics going because the self-doubt was overwhelming. How could I have possibly come up with something original like this? So my husband said, Damien, said that psychiatrists were too expensive. We were going to go to England and sit down with a Neolithic expert. Because I was coming from a university, she had to grant me 1 hour because she's with English Heritage. Can you imagine how many nutter Stonehenge theories she's got to listen to?
Oh, yes.
So she had a minder there ready to get rid of me.
And you're acting your most sane.
Trying. I was so nervous. I was physically sick before it and I don't normally get that nervous. 4 hours later, she said, "You're doing my head in. We've never thought this way." I lent her Howard Morphy's book on Aboriginal Art as a System of Knowledge. That's the approximate title. And she said, "Please come back tomorrow." So went back the next day. This was in 2010. And she said, "No, there's no elephant in the room. This is a completely new approach."
Let's say you're right about Stonehenge. Indigenous people in Australia and in the Americas have said, yes, 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 that's how you remember things. Polynesian people have said yes and carefully, patiently taken you through it all. Why don't we use this, all of us, all the time now? What happened that this way of remembering sort of declined?
Writing's easier. Literacy literally overwrites orality. These methods were used right through all ancient Greek and Roman schools. There's one textbook that survived called the Ad Herennium that describes this method and how it's taught in schools. It then goes on and it gets adapted in the Middle Ages and into the Renaissance, and then it gets dropped out of schools because writing and books are just so much easier.
Do you think our memory declined as literacy came in the picture?
Absolutely. And I think we're going even further. People say to me, "Why do you need to memorize anything? You can just look it up on Google."
Right.
To look something up on Google, you've got to know what you're looking up. And what I'm finding with using these systems is that I'm adding information that I wouldn't have thought of to look up, and I'm adding structure. And that's what I think we've lost a lot in education. I'd love to see these memory methods brought back in.
Give us an example of a few. If you're going to give a speech, how do you use memory methods so that you're not reliant on the bit of paper?
Okay, I divide the speech up into, say, 20 separate things I want to say in order. I whack some kind of link to each of those things to the locations that I use as my basic, which start at the bookshelf in my office, to my desk, to my photo of my father, to the window, and then... So say in the speech I want to talk about Chichen Itza, the site in Mexico. Out the window, I can see it. I imagine it out the window. So when I get to that window in the speech, Chichen Itza will come straight to me. So then I just imagine myself moving around the room and then out into the garden, and each piece of the speech just comes back.
So you when you've divided it into 20, you then say each bit is a place and I'm going on a walk in my mind and that's how I remember it, which is
exactly.
a great technique. Has that, using that sort of technique, changed your brain?
I feel it has, but then the only thing I've got to analyse my brain is my brain. But I'm starting to play with stories. So, for example, when I'm with my bird guide, in order to tell the Pacific gull from the kelp gull, one has a bit of red on the top of its beak, the Pacific gull, and not the kelp gull. So it's the specific drunk gull to me. So when I'm playing with those characters, because they've become real characters, I've got them as almost human going on. The kelp gull's a health fanatic yelling at the Pacific gull about, you know, getting drunk all the time. But when I'm down at the beach and see one of these large gulls, then they become birds and I look at them as birds. So that sort of morphing of ideas and playing around with images and fun things, and some of them get crude or politically incorrect or whatever, but of course that doesn't come out of your mouth. It's only going on in your head.
Mm. And you've said that as you start to use these techniques more and more, you're less and less able to describe what your mind is doing in the way that you just have.
Yes, because it happens visually, which is so different from speech. So I jump. If you name a country, I will jump to that location in my imagination. The stories will sort of all get imagined there. And St. Augustine used this method, and he described it as you contemplate that location, all of the different things are saying, hey me, hey me, hey me. The one you want, you will withdraw and tell the others to wait till next time. So you're making these selections. You've got these massive images and the landscape is alive and you choose what you want.
And given that when there was first contact between Indigenous cultures and between Western cultures, and one thought in terms of things written down on a piece of paper, that's how Western thought had developed and Indigenous thought had continued to develop in this way. I suppose, does that account for, in part, why Indigenous people struggle to explain their knowledge systems and why non-Indigenous people struggle to understand?
I think partly non-Indigenous people didn't try. You've got Sigmund Freud 100 years ago describing Australian Aboriginals the most miserable of savages and, you know, not having morals like us. Yeah, so many of the stories are ethical and moral, but we were so busy teaching literacy and civilising them that we didn't even look for orality, and that they had an alternative, didn't treat them as intellectual equals.
And just a final point. These days you can feel like you're busy. Everybody's always busy and they've got so much to remember. Relative to how much a Polynesian navigator had to remember, an Indigenous Australian had to remember about his or her environment, how much do we actually have in our minds now and how much more could we shove in there?
What an interesting question. I am convinced there is no limit to what I could shove in there. I haven't got it there. It's given 3 years of using these methods, I know so much more than I used to know. But that doesn't mean I didn't have other skills. It's not that literacy isn't hugely valuable. It's different. The thing is, you need to meditate, as Augustine or Cicero would have said, on these ideas and not move fast. I found the faster I tried to put them in, the less effective it was. Playing with the ideas and the stories and the characters. So it's a completely different way of dealing with information. And I think there's an optimum combination. Just don't know it yet.
Well, I'm sure that there are students all around Australia who are finishing year 12 who are thinking hard about patient play and visualisation and storytelling and hope that that will get them through their exams and maybe will enliven their minds for their lives. What a fascinating bit of research, Lynn. Thank you so much for telling us about it.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure being here.
Lynn Kelly, author of The Memory Code and associate researcher at La Trobe.